Hello, mental health champs, and a warm welcome to yet another episode on the show. If you're listening to the sound of my voice for the first time, well, you're listening to the Mental Health Podcast, and I am your host, Erike Tumafivo. The Mental Health Podcast was created out of the depths of my heart to show up, speak up, and be boldly honest about my beliefs and the magic, and also to create even more awareness on mental health and mental health challenges. In any episode reach your heart or leave a spark within, leave a review and share with your friends so the podcast can reach more people and create even more heartfelt sparks. And I believe in synchronicity and not coincidence, so if you find yourself listening to any of these episodes, maybe there's a jewel for you in here especially. And maybe heartbeat by heartbeat, we'll all be able to create a world where human emotions are prioritized even more. So sit back as we dive right into the conversation. Hello everyone, thank you so much for sticking around. So on today's episode, we're going to be talking about something quite important and the future of mental health care. And we have an amazing guest. Now, Dr. Peter is the partner and the co-founder and the president of Central Ohio Bureau of Medicine. He's a graduate of the Ohio State University College of Medicine. Dr. Peter completed his psychiatry residency at Ohio State University Hospital Department of Psychiatry. Now, during his residency, he received awards, both clinical and teaching experience. Dr. Peter also served as the chief resident in his final year, and him and his partners founded Central Ohio Bureau of Medicine in 1997. As a board psychiatrist, Dr. Peter has extensive experience in evaluation and medical management of depression, anxiety disorders, ADHD, bipolar disorders, and schizophrenia. His specific area of interest within psychiatry is the body and mind role of emotions and physical illnesses. I honestly cannot wait to get right into this conversation. So sit back, bring your headsets as we dive right into the conversation. Thank you so much, Dr. Peter, for taking our time to be part of today's episode. We honestly do not take it for granted, and I cannot wait to gain a lot of insights from your well of knowledge. So, Dr. Peter, could you do us the honors by introducing yourself and what you primarily do as of this moment in the field of psychiatry?
Yes, I'd be happy to. We are a smaller psychiatric practice here in Columbus, Ohio. There's three of us, and most of us have been together for a long period of time. My partner and I have been in practice together since 1997. So it's been a wonderful journey together over these last almost three decades together. Primarily, it is adult psychiatry with a lot of emphasis on depression and anxiety. I also treat a fair amount of ADD. We are in a college population town here, so we see a fair amount of ADD as well in our student population. My specific area of interest in psychiatry, though, is in the interface of chronic pain and emotion. Specifically, I see individuals who are struggling with chronic pain that might not have any identifiable pathology. Nothing is showing up on imaging. There hasn't been an injury, but there is chronic pain. Or there has been something that shows up on imaging, but yet traditional physicians have not been able to get the pain under control. And my emphasis has been on looking at what the functional role of chronic pain is with regards to emotions. And let me explain that. in those individuals, I want people to understand that the pain itself is not neurotic or hypochondriacal or due to a personality defect. Pain in those individuals is functional. There's a purpose to it. And the purpose of the chronic pain is to protect as a survival-based distraction, if you will, away from a deeper emotional pain. So the physical pain helps protect from what is perceived to be an even more dangerous emotional pain that is underneath. So we go through the process of therapy and techniques to allow some of those emotions to come to the surface, to see that they are not that terrifying. And in there, we can see people's pain improve and hopefully remit completely beyond the treatment that I do. I've also been a chronic back pain sufferer for many, many years back in the 90s. And it was the work of another clinician, Dr. John Sarno, who talked about tension myositis syndrome and the role of emotions and pain that helped me completely remit from pain after many years. And it has been a couple decades and I've been pain free. So beyond helping others with it, I personally had suffered with it. So that drives me. So a combination of traditional psychiatry, but also an emphasis on the mind-body aspect, the role of pain and emotions as we understand why people suffer so much.
Wow, that is so, so much. Thank you so much, Dr. Peter. Okay, so now let's dive right into the reason why we are here. Now, Dr. Peter, on today's episode, we're going to be talking about the future of healthcare. And you have been somebody that has been actively involved in the mental health space for quite some time. So how has the field of mental health care evolved since you began your career? And what do you see as the most recent and significant development all these years?
Well, first of all, thank you, Rikitoma, for having me on your podcast. It's my honor and my privilege. I look forward to having a good conversation together. With regards to how the field of mental health care has evolved during my career, there's so many different aspects of it. I've been in practice now for 27 years. It's hard to believe. I guess one of the main things that I've seen change has been the advancement of pharmacotherapy, the treatment of medications, and how they have evolved over the years to be cleaner, to be more specific, and to very thoughtfully treat patients. So along the biological model, I think the evolution of medications has been important. Along that line, though, more significantly, and where the future may go there, is where some of the psychedelic medications are being researched now, particularly psilocybin. And it will be interesting to see. Some of the preliminary data is phenomenal on psilocybin. It's been so unfortunate that at least over the last half century, these drugs have been so restricted that even research scientists couldn't investigate them. So it is a wonderful development to see that. Additionally, some of the interventional treatments that we have, whether it is the transmagnetic stimulation, transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, all of these new and different ways that we can treat some of these mental health issues. On the psychotherapeutic part of this, the advancements have been huge. I remember when I first started, the emphasis was almost exclusively on psychoanalytic and Freudian therapy. And the movement, as we've seen over the decades, into cognitive behavioral therapy, and really more recently, particularly in the era of trauma, in the area of trauma, EMDR, eye movement therapy, that has been phenomenal and really has had a renaissance over the last 10 or 15 years has really been a godsend to many individuals with trauma. So I think with regards to the advances, whether they're biological or psychotherapeutic, that is what I would see as some of the biggest changes during my career in psychiatry.
Now, this has been amazing. Thank you so much. That's quite a lot, and I honestly just heard a lot of new words for the first time. So, moving forward, Dr. Peter, could you share your insights on the integration of body-mind approaches in mental health care, and particularly when it comes to addressing chronic pain and its relationship to emotional well-being? I'd love to hear your insights on that.
That's a great question, Erkitoma. And it works both ways, right? Here, the mind-body relationship as the emotions relate to pain and as pain relates to emotion. And as I described earlier, the area of interest that I have is what are the role of emotions and chronic pain, specifically where pain is a protective or a survival-based distraction from deeper emotions that come underneath. And we fear that which we are not sure of. But I really do believe in the strength and the power of the individual, of all of us. And we can face any of those challenges, no matter how deep we fear them, if we just give them the light of day. And I think that when we approach this mind-body perspective, the psychophysiologic disorder, or what Dr. John Sarno had called tension myositis syndrome, and we first broach the subject that your pain can be a protective against these emotions, and we have to let these emotions out, but you must not be afraid of these emotions. They won't hurt you if we discuss, and people allow for that to come out. We do see improvement, not only in mental well-being, but physical well-being as well. That being said, every pain that comes into my office is not this mind-body psychophysiologic disorders pain. Legitimate pain, people might have had an injury, they might have been in an accident, what have you, and there is profound physical pain that is coming from a known disorder. And in that, we do our best to right the ship emotionally, because we know that if we can make people feel better emotionally through our treatments, be they medications, therapy, or the combination of both, ideally, pain will improve, because there is this circular relationship between emotional pain and physical pain. I always tell people, think of evolution. When are we stressed in our ancestral past, let's say back 100,000 years ago? It probably was when we were coming under attack by predators, right? So in that, it does make sense that when we're our most stressed, we need our nervous system to be very intense, to let us know of pain or weakness in our body so that we can adapt properly and escape from that threat. So it makes sense that when we are more stressed, anxious, and depressed, we are going to feel pain more. So not that the pain isn't real, but that pain that we feel is very, very real and heightened because of the stress. So if we can diminish anxiety, we can diminish depression, it makes sense that what we would see is an improvement in physical pain as well. So through coping skills that people are taught, through relaxation, through mindfulness, through meditation, through medications that we may use, the goal is all the same, to minimize the emotional suffering, which will then send back a feedback to lower the intensity of physical pain that we feel that is rooted into us from evolution. And we can't escape that, but we can impact it through our treatment techniques.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really wonderful. And I'm so glad that more innovations are now coming into the mental health space. And I'm looking forward to seeing even more and more. So as someone with a strong background in psychotherapy, how would you see the role of therapy
evolving in the future of mental health care, especially in the light of advancements in technology and telemedicine?
Now, that's a great question. Certainly with COVID and the world turned upside down, it was an amazing switch that we had to make within our practice and go online almost immediately to telemedicine. We were completely unprepared. We had never had to face anything like this, just like everybody else. But there had been some telemedicine that had been permitted, but there had to be special licenses and agreements made, and on a dime, everything switched with the pandemic. I didn't know what to think at first. It felt a bit odd, but specifically, is it related to psychiatry? People, I think, adapted very, very well. It is one of the few specialties in medicine where I think telemedicine can work quite well for therapy and for psychiatry. I still prefer the in-person visit compared to telemedicine, but people are more likely to stick with a visit if they have a telemedicine option. I have much fewer cancellations. If people aren't feeling well or don't have transportation, they can simply get on telemedicine and we can have a discussion and a treatment session. And there's a practicality to that. And on a broader level, treatment continues and people continue to feel better. It'll be interesting to see. I am fascinated by some of the virtual reality that is coming out, both within the Oculus and especially now Apple Vision Pro. I had seen a fascinating episode of the Lex Fridman show in which both he and Mark Zuckerberg were wearing the Oculus VR headsets, and their avatars were themselves, perfect avatars, replications of themselves, talking in real time in a virtual room. And I thought to myself, my goodness, if this can be replicated for therapy, imagine how that could impact treatment, where we could literally, instead of sitting on screens looking at each other in two dimensions and a bit removed, literally meet in a VR room where we could sit down and have a conversation literally face to face, no matter where we are in the world. So it's amazing to see where the future may go. I'm hopeful. I think within psychiatry, telemedicine has been wonderful. And I look forward to the future and where technology takes us, specifically for psychotherapy.
So, Dr. Peter, you prefer the old traditional therapy to telemedicine. Okay, so speaking on that, what are your thoughts on the growing use of digital mental health tools and apps for diagnosis, monitoring, and treatment? How do you see these technologies impacting the future of mental health care delivery?
Yes, I guess I am a traditionalist, but I do think that there is a lot to be said for two human beings sitting together in a room, being vulnerable and compassionate and caring with each other, period. That's not to diminish telemedicine. That can be achieved there as well and will likely have a larger role in the future. But I do think that there is a special kind of intimacy in a face-to-face, human-to-human. So in that regard, I guess I am a traditionalist. It's very interesting to see where digital therapeutics are going and where they may go in the future. I am very encouraged by the technological advances, particularly in the AI space. I am in contact with a professor at Ohio State University who is working on a particular AI interface for psychology and psychiatry, particularly in diagnostic assessment. And I think that that is going to be a wonderful addition to help us in terms of properly diagnosing individuals as an aid. Also, I have seen and have tried out a few of the AI or chatbot mental health therapists, if you will, online. They are amazingly engaging and quite impressive in the questions that they do ask. And this is just the first generation or two. It will be very interesting to see if we can get to a point where we are rendering, instead of chatbots, we are rendering actual avatars of human beings who might act as AI therapists, perhaps for those individuals who may not have access to a telemedicine or an in-face therapist, or don't have the affordability to be able to engage that. Obviously, a lot of work has to be done, but you can see the beginnings of what could be a very promising future within the realm of digital therapeutics, especially for psychology and mental health.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I mean, at the moment, AI is taking over almost everything, you know, and I'm honestly looking forward to seeing more advancements. I'm not even going to lie. So, with increasing recognition of the importance of mental health in overall well-being, I mean, mental health wasn't this recognized, but in recent time, I am super glad that more people are now becoming advocates, more people are now becoming more intentional about their mental health. I mean, so how do you envision the future of mental health care when it comes to accessibility, affordability, and stigma reduction, you know?
This is a really great question, Erica Toma. I'm glad you brought this up. It has been a sea change, it seems like, over certainly my career, in the awareness and destigmatization, if you will, of mental health and what it means to be depressed and anxious. I think there are multiple reasons as to why this has happened. I think growing awareness over the years, moving away from some of these very stigmatized therapies as well, such as psychoanalysis, and moving into more traditional types of therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy and supportive psychotherapy and positive psychology that feels more accessible to more people. Also, I think more public recognition of emotional illness, whether it is in those who are in the public sphere, celebrities, musicians, politicians, etc., who dare to come out, or everyday citizens who dare to come out and talk about these disorders and take them out of the dark and put them into the light of day. And I hope in the future, certainly insurance companies are being more positive for those that carry insurance to approve treatment for emotional illnesses. This certainly is important. The fact that we see emotional illnesses as, at least in the United States, protected health conditions under America with disabilities. I'm sorry, Americans with Disability Acts. Let me say that again when you edit this. Under the ADA or Americans with Disabilities Act, so that you have protection at work should you be depressed or anxious. A lot of these things come together to allow for a better awareness and less stigma, period. That being said, we still have so much to do because stigma is still very prevalent, even in the 21st century. And as I tell people, as I try to write in some of the articles that I do, whether it's on my website or on LinkedIn, stigma still kills. It kills because people still do not feel that they can be as free with these emotional disorders, and it costs oftentimes their lives. So while we have come a long way, there is still a long way to go. But I'm hopeful for the future. I've seen it progress so beautifully in my almost 30 years of practice, and I don't think there's any reason to believe that it's going backwards.
Yes, I completely agree with you. You know, in as much as we're trying as much as possible to break the stigma that prevents people from, you know, seeking help, people still find it so difficult to ask for help and to come and to be open with their mental health conditions. Like celebrities, like you pointed out, they would be so scared. How would my life turn out? Will I still get more fans, you know, and all of those anxiety that comes along with having a mental health condition. So, Dr. Peter, as a leader in your field, what advice would you give mental health professionals and organizations preparing for the future of mental health care? And when I mean by leaders, I'm also referring to myself as well, because I see myself getting more and more actively involved in the mental health care space. So yeah, expect so much from me as well.
Wow, that's a really good question. What advice would I give to mental health professionals? I guess the most important thing is make sure that you absolutely love what you do. Because, and again, it's just me, I'm one person, but in this therapy room that I am in right now, as I'm talking to you, I really do consider this a sacred space. It's a sacred space when someone comes in here and takes all of their strength and risks with their vulnerability to talk about things that are very, very difficult. First off, how important that is and how sacred that is. Secondly, that you are permitted to be in that space, and the humility and the gratitude and the appreciation you must hold for allowing someone to trust in you is absolutely amazing to me. And I never take that for granted. And I think the most important thing is being sure you're in it for the right reasons. And also understanding that while we dedicate much of our lives to learning about the process and the methods in which we can help individuals, nothing is more important than the relationship. Someone has to feel comfortable with you to be able to be vulnerable to you. And in that, I think the vulnerability has to work both ways. You must be willing to give of yourself as well. Give of yourself in being able to empathize properly when appropriate, to self-disclose and become vulnerable as well yourself. It shows authenticity and it shows caring. So those would be some of the things that I would say if you are in this field that would be important to have as you move through your career. It certainly has sustained me, and I can't think of anything else in the world that I'd rather be doing.
Wow, Dr. Peter, thank you so much for your wonderful insights thus far. Hope applications are open, because me, I want to fill an application so you can become my mentor. Okay, so moving forward. So, Dr. Peter, moving forward to the next question. Now, you are a certified board psychiatrist at Ohio Behavioral Medicine, Central Ohio Behavioral Medicine. So, I mean, can you discuss any innovation approaches or initiatives that you and your team are undertaking to improve mental health care delivery?
Yes, we, as I had said, have been in practice for about 27 years now, since 1997. I don't know about any innovations, but from the beginning, for us, particularly my partner, Julie Guthrie, and I, it was important for us that we would see, even if it is medication management, no more than two people an hour. So the smallest visit anyone would have at our office would be a 30-minute visit, because the medication information can be taken care of fairly quickly, those types of decisions. So it still gave us a fair amount of time to be able to sit with our patients and do some therapy. Over the years, I've tried to stay true to what I've learned in psychotherapy and have maintained, as I know my partner has, many individuals that we see for our therapies. So we're not saying that this is the best way to do it. It is simply our way. And we just wanted it to be a practice where it wasn't going to be that people were going to be seen every 15 minutes. Medication decision made, next person. Medication decision made, next person. So I think that has been one fundamental principle that we've held on to over the years. As far as certain innovations outside of moving to telemedicine and also going fully digital within our platforms so that we can administer our care and patients can be in touch with us, we've tried to stay pretty true to that traditional model.
Wow, amazing, amazing, Dr. Peter. We have spoke a lot and we've shared ideas, and I'm super grateful for this opportunity to make a difference and for you being here. It's such an honor and I do not take your time for granted. So I think the two more questions as we wrap up. So in your experience, what are some key challenges and opportunities facing the future of mental health care, and how do we address them effectively?
Well, that's very kind, Erica Toma. The privilege and the honor is mine. Thank you for allowing me to be part of this discussion, and I really do appreciate it as well. It's an interesting time with mental health and mental health care. I think today in 2024, there's probably never been a time where there has been more awareness about issues of mental health, whether it is depression or anxiety or substance abuse or bipolar or suicide. There is so much awareness in the public space. I think it's fair to say there's never been a time where there have been more available practitioners in all disciplines within mental health, whether it is psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, and other treaters in the allied health within mental health care treatment. We have some of the most revolutionary treatments we've ever had in the history of certainly psychiatry, just within my own career, to see where we have advanced to and the potential that is coming in the future, whether it is some of the future pharmacological treatments, interventional treatments, and the interface of AI. So there is so much promise. But at the same time, at the very same time, occurring simultaneously is the ongoing stigma that is there, despite the awareness, despite the availability of good treatments and learned professionals across all disciplines within mental health. Stigma is still there. So despite all of this, people are still hesitant. They may not feel comfortable about talking about it. Certainly in underprivileged classes, whether they are socioeconomic or otherwise, there is much more stigma. Within cultural classes of individuals, there is not the discussion or the willingness to talk about mental health issues. And we have to reconcile this and realize that while we have a lot to be proud of and happy for and thankful with regards to treatment, there is so much that we still have to do because of stigma that is still prevalent and ongoing. So it is a simultaneous period of opportunity, but also tremendous challenge. And we just have to be aware of it and continue to push forward so that everyone can have access to good and equal care for mental health issues.
Thank you so much, Dr. Peter. This has been wonderful and I super enjoyed my time and I gained a lot of insights and I'm pretty sure my listeners also gained a tin or two from this conversation. So as we wrap up the conversation, what advice do you have for our listeners on the future of mental health care?
Well, thank you, Erica Toma, for having me on the show and allowing this discussion to happen. I greatly appreciate your wonderful questions, and I hope I answered them in the manner that serves your listeners to the best that it can. I guess for the future of mental health and the listeners, I'll share a story. People will always ask me when I tell them what I do, I'm a psychiatrist. They always say, oh, how can you do that? Don't you get tired of hearing about people's problems? And it always makes me smile. And I respond the same way every time. I just don't see it that way. What I see is an individual who comes in and isn't telling me about their everyday problems. I am seeing a human being who comes in suffering, oftentimes years or decades, with profound depression or anxiety or other mental health issues, but has still carved out a life of purpose and meaning. They have families, they have children, they have careers, they have responsibilities, they have obligations, and they meet them despite these problems that they have emotionally. And I think to myself, who's stronger? Who's stronger? The individual who has all these responsibilities and attends to them, or the person who, despite all of the adversity, dares to continue to carve out a life? And all I see is strength. All I see is strength. My only goal in treatment is to make sure that these individuals realize the true strength that is within them, that their mental illness does not define them, and it is nothing to be ashamed of, and it is a testament to their strength and their determination that they dare to carve out lives of meaning despite the adversity that their mental health issues cause in their lives. So to me, it's a very inspiring story. If you are struggling, do not hesitate to get help. Do not be ashamed. Find someone who will listen to you. If you don't feel comfortable with the person that you are seeing, should you go get treatment, find another. Because to me, the relationship is everything. And if it doesn't feel right for you, seek another professional. Don't be ashamed. The power is yours. And you will and you can get better. You will get better. I absolutely believe it. And I've seen it throughout my 3 decades of treatment. These are some of the strongest individuals I've ever met in my entire life. And you are one of those as well.
Okay, this has been so wonderful, Dr. Peter. So just in case my listeners want to, you know, dive more deeper into the work that you do, could you leave a link or a website or your LinkedIn or your blog where they can go and, you know, gain even deeper insights from you? Could we get that?
Absolutely. If people want any more information or want to see some of the writing that I do, our practice website is centralohiobehavioralmedicine.com. I know it's a long link, but it's centralohiobehavioralmedicine.com. And right at the top of the homepage is the blog, and I write articles routinely. I can also be found at LinkedIn as well. I would imagine if people just type in my name at LinkedIn,
All of my articles are there, and I probably write more articles and posts at LinkedIn than I do on the blog. But those would be the two places to find me. If anyone has any particular questions, I don't have any problem sharing my email. That would be zafshrink@yahoo.com. So those would be the way to get in touch with me. I thank you very much, Rigatoma, for the opportunity, and I look forward to maybe having a discussion in the future about mental health. Congratulations on all your success on your podcast, and may that continue into the future.
And it's a wrap. Thank you so much, everyone, for taking our time to listen to the end as we wrap up this episode on the future of mental health care. I am reminded of the importance of hope and innovation when it comes to shaping a brighter tomorrow. Thank you so much, Dr. Peter, for taking our time to be part of the episode and for sharing your well of knowledge. Let us continue to advocate for accessible, holistic, and compassionate mental health care for all. And I believe that together we can create a future where mental health is prioritized, stigma is dismantled, and healing is accessible to absolutely everyone, irrespective of age, gender, and race. Thank you for joining me on this journey towards a healthier and more compassionate world. Till next time, don't forget, this is the Mental Health Podcast, and I am your host, Irike Tomafivo, and this is where I draw the curtain on today's episode, The Future of Mental Health Care. Don't forget, I love you, but God loves you more.